And we have our guest on the line. Let's introduce him first. Dr. Dennis Stanford. Without tonight's guest, there would not be a World Salutrian Day this April 20th, which coincidentally happens to be the first day of summer in Iceland and Earth Day, among others. He's the head of the Archaeology Division and director of the Paleo-Varangian Program at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian Institution. Along with Dr. Bruce Bradley, tonight's guest, is known for advocating the Salutrian hypothesis, which contends that stone tool technology of the Salutrian culture in prehistoric Europe may have influenced the development of the Clovis tool-making culture in the Americas. And this being World Salutrian Weekend, it's very apt that we have him on so he could explain this to you and a part of history that's been lost for thousands upon thousands of years is finally coming to light. So let us please welcome the father of Salutria, Dr. Dennis Stanford. Welcome to The Right Perspective, Dr. Stanford.
Thank you very much.
I'm Frank of Queens.
And I'm John of Staten Island.
And could you please tell us how you came to the Salutrian hypothesis?
After a number of years of working in the American Arctic and finally in Siberia, looking for the origins of Clovis, it became clear that none of the technologies that we found in either Alaska or Siberia were particularly related to Clovis. So we began to look elsewhere in the Paleolithic world and found that in northern Spain and extreme southwestern France, lithic technology known there as the Salutrian had an awfully lot of stone tools and bone tools that appear to be related to Clovis. In other words, they're all manufactured the same way, and that the Salutrian material was several thousand years older than Clovis, which at first blush would seem to be a problem. And at second blush, one has to worry about the Ice Age North Atlantic Ocean. And the Salutrian people lived roughly 21 to 16,000 years ago, at which time, this is one of the coldest times in recorded prehistory. And a lot of the North Atlantic was actually frozen solid, and there was an ice bridge that connected Europe to North America. And at the time, there was hunting in Europe was probably pretty poor because most of Europe was covered with ice, the glaciers of the last ice age, and essentially Europe was probably a pretty hard place to live with catabolic winds blowing off the glaciers, and it was a polar desert, basically. So people had pretty well migrated towards the ocean where things were a little bit warmer. The climate would have ameliorated somewhat there because of the water. And it's our contention that people began to hunt sea mammals and seabirds along the ice front, and eventually worked probably by boat along the ice edge. And some of them apparently ended up in North America, probably in the area we now call the Grand Banks, which because of the last ice age, the sea level had dropped roughly 150 to 200 feet. So a lot of the what we call the continental shelves along North America and Europe were actually dry land. So it wasn't quite as far across the North Atlantic then than it is now. And that's what we think happened. And sure enough, we are now finding, particularly here on the east coast of North America, the oldest archaeological sites in the New World. One down near Richmond, Virginia, another right on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake, and one up in Pennsylvania. And these sites are dating into the Salutrian time period. And sure enough, the stone tools, which is all we have in North America at this point, were manufactured almost the same as the Salutrian stone tools, and were a whole lot different than what we found in Siberia. So it looks pretty reasonable to us that these Ice Age peoples from northern Spain actually did make it to the New World some, 14,000 to 15,000 years before Christopher Columbus.
My goodness. Well, let me ask you, when they set out on their epic voyages, what kind of boats do you think that they used? Were they skin boats? Were they?
Well, we think they probably used skin boats. Probably a boat very similar to the Eskimo Umiak, or large open whaling boat, or even the Karak, which is a skin boat used up until recently, if not actually. One went from Ireland all the way across to Nova Scotia here about 20 years ago. And these kind of boats are reasonably easy to make. And when you use them correctly, they're very, very seaworthy craft. And unlike the Titanic, when you get in and around the ice, you can pretty well avoid collision. And if for some reason you do happen to hit some ice or something, you can actually sew up the boat and waterproof it and keep on going.
I want to ask you, how many people do you think went in each boat? How many people do you think they had?
Well, we have no way to know that. I know that on some of these Eskimo skin boats, you can get up to 20 people in a boat. And, you know, if you had two or three boats and people hunting out on the ice edge, and you could actually live on the ice edge, just like Eskimos have in the past. There's plenty to eat. There's fresh water, and you know, they could get a fair number of people across there. And it might have been totally accidental, just people out there working the edge, and then when they got to the Grand Banks, they found that it's a whole new continent. And one of the major issues, I think, that was attracted to them was the a source of wood, because Europe was a polar desert, whereas the Atlantic seaboard of North America was in part forested. And a lot of that wood was ending up in what we now call the Gulf Current, and actually working its way across the Atlantic Ocean and into Europe. So they knew there was a source of wood to the west, and you know, it was probably a pretty attractive thing when you think about wood. It's a real valuable item.
Now, when our Salutrian ancestors came here, see, I believe in this emphatically, because I just don't. It seems to me that we're living in an age where, for example, last week we had on Dr. James Chatters, who reconstructed the face of our ancestor, the Kennewick man. And to me, Dr. Stanford, we've become to the point where there's such dogmatic thinking about the peopling of America that it's similar to those who said to Copernicus, you're wrong, it's heresy to say that the Earth revolves around the sun. I mean, you know, when we're dealing with prehistory, you know, we can't be dogmatic about it and come to these definite conclusions that this is exactly the way it was, because when someone like you unearths this evidence, it totally, there are a lot of people that have too much invested in academia to allow this, and there's this whole culture of the Beringians being these wise and noble people, this romanticism about them. But I would like to ask you, could you tell us about a couple of the excavation sites, such as Cactus Hill in Virginia?
Cactus Hill is a stratified site. In other words, you have successively older human occupations, starting from the ground surface, where you'd have colonial material, and then you work right on down to what's important there is you get into the Paleo-Indian, which is what we call the earliest archaeological horizon, and you have a Clovis level with typical Clovis artifacts. And what wouldn't surprise anybody that deals in Paleo-Indian. But then the people who were excavating it went deeper, and they found a level below Clovis, which was somewhat different than Clovis, but related in many respects, such as it had a large blade technology and projectile points that were similar to Clovis, only they weren't fluted, which is the characteristic flake taken from the base of a Clovis point, usually on both sides of the base. It gives it a hollow ground appearance. The projectile points found below Clovis were not fluted. And so it was pretty exciting. And then they got a radiocarbon date of 16,900 years old. And that was pretty shocking to most everybody in North American archaeology. However, at a site known as Meadowcroft up in Pennsylvania on a drainage of the Ohio River in southwest Pennsylvania, a similar type projectile point had been found back in the 70s by investigators working in that rock shelter, and they had a date that was almost 13 to 14,000 years old. And the archaeologist at the time wouldn't buy that site as being valid because of the notion that it was coal contamination made the radiocarbon date older than it was. So the two sites supported each other, and now we have a third site on the western shore of the Chesapeake, which has actually a slightly older date and the same kinds of unfluted bifacially flaked projectile points with the blade technology and quite close to the technology of the Solutrean people. So I think the story is beginning to fall together here. And clearly we're a long way from the Bering Land Bridge and the ice-free corridor that we all learned in college and high school as to the route that the first Americans came. And it's now beginning to look as though that might have been the route that they came much, much later in time. But, of course, a lot of people did come from Northeast Asia. And probably at the end of, or maybe even slightly later than Clovis, or at the same time as Clovis, and then they populated the west coast of the Americas. And at some time, around 10,900 years ago, we had culture contact. And the descendants of the Solutrean, or the people we call Clovis, then met Asian people that were coming down the west coast. And eventually some of them did come down through the ice-free corridor. But much later than the Clovis time period. So the people in America is actually a really complicated picture, with multiple migrations coming from multiple places, and we don't have the full story yet. In fact, like you say, when we begin to say yes, that's it, that's our dogma, then I know we're wrong. We only have a small part of the picture.
Now, could you tell our audience, please, who might not be familiar with it, what you mean by fluting at the bottom of the spear point?
Okay, fluting is a technique of stone tool manufacture where you make a projectile point to kind of, well, it sort of looks like a surfboard with a concave end. And what they did was took a very large flake that ran parallel to the edges of the sides of the projectile point, but only right down the middle. and that flake would go down maybe a third of the distance from the base of the point towards the tip, and you get this hollow ground effect on both sides, kind of like a bayonet when you have a rill in the side, both sides of the bayonet. That in the bayonet, it was used as a way to allow blood to escape. However, in the Clovis projectile point, it was basically a hafting technique, because a projectile point would be used like an end blade on a harpoon harpoon head, and it'd be the harpoon head itself would have a slot, and you would wedge the Clovis point into the slot, and then tie it to the harpoon, and then that would be affixed to the foreshaft. So it's basically a weaponry that was very suited for sea mammal hunting.
Well, you know, James Chattis said that he had, after he restored the face of Kennewick Man, that he had been harassed and he had been threatened because of this. But have you found that in academia you've been attacked or ridiculed because of your theory?
Well, there's certainly a number of people that are opposed to the theory. And, yeah, we've had a number of negative reviews of our work, which you would expect. That's science.
Right.
It's a different point of view. But those people that have that negative point of view, they don't have an alternate solution.
Right.
And basically what they're saying is that we're looking at a convergence of technology. In other words, it's accidental that the Clovis and
right.
the Solutrean material look so much the same. And that's a possibility. But they need to prove it. And we've found at this point in time so many technological landmarks that we can compare the Solutrean to the Clovis and what we're calling the pre-Clovis, and we can see the development, the evolution of the technology, where I think at this point in time we have 31 or 32 tool types and technologies that we can link between the two time periods, whereas linking Clovis to anything in the Paleolithic of Siberia is impossible.
Right.
There's virtually nothing there. And in fact, if you found the Solutrean toolkit in eastern Siberia, everybody says, oh, yes, absolutely. That's clearly the origin of Clovis technologies right there. But unfortunately, we're on the other side of the world from where people would expect the origins of Clovis to be.
It's just hard
for people to get around.
How did you come upon this? From what I understand, I think I saw you in was it Nova on PBS, that you had noticed this in what, in a textbook or something? Could you explain that to our audience, how you how you saw the similarity?
Well, a number of people have pointed out in the past some of the similarities, particularly the projectile points, but nobody had seriously looked at the issue in any depth because of the two problems. The time period, there's, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years difference in time between classic Solutrean and classic Clovis, and the fact that the big old North Atlantic Ocean was out there. And it's only been in the last few years that we've discovered that Paleolithic peoples had boats going back almost 50, maybe 60,000 years ago. And that's 30,000 years between what we know as the first boat and Solutrean times. And that's a long time for research and development. And I'm pretty sure that the Solutrean people not only had watercraft, they knew how to sail, they knew how to navigate. And after all, we're dealing with modern human beings. And as a matter of fact, it looks as though that the first people to come into North America from Asia were likely coming by boat rather than walking across the land bridge. So it's an interesting story of human ingenuity and people just trying to make a living during the coldest time period that modern humans have ever lived in.
You know, in one of the detractions of your theory, as they say, well, the Salutrian culture in Europe had disappeared by the time these spear points were found. But I say that were created, but I say, well, over periods of thousands of years that they were separated from them. Of course, they were going, may have died out in Europe, but it does not mean that it could not have existed still and continued over here.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up because we know the European Paleolithic record pretty well because people have been working on it for several hundred years. And you have the classic European Paleolithic technology going along, and then all of a sudden, 22-some thousand years ago, the Salutri technology shows up right at the time of the height of the last ice age. And we don't know where it comes from. We don't know where it goes in Europe, because at the end of the ice age, the Salutrian technology is gone. And it's back to the same technology that was going on in Europe before the Salutrian people. So the origins of Salutrian itself, as well as what happened to it, is an interesting archaeological problem for the Europeans as well. And maybe we're beginning to get some of that answer here in North America.
Well, you know, someone who reads about archaeology, it's always that, and it was proven at the site at Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, that societies build upon older societies. You know, the area draws people to it because of its natural resources. And I truly believe when they begin, if more excavation is done and more research, they will find more Salutrian sites within this country because it took these people thousands of years to reach the West Coast. So obviously...
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. So therefore, a lot of it shouldn't be written off, and the proof is there, but it's waiting to be seen. The only problem is that you have this obstinance. We've seen this with Kennewick Man, where they have tried to do every type of verbal contortion imaginable to say that he's not of European descent. And it seems that this is what they're doing with the Salutrians. I mean, I think the Salutrian people lived very lightly on the land, and that's why they didn't leave that much of a record of it. But there is a record, and you're going to find more records.
Oh, absolutely. You're right about that. And I think now that we've pretty well demonstrated that somebody's here during that time period, other archaeologists will try harder to find a similar record in their own area. And I think they will. I think the dam is broken, and the water of the ice is going to come rushing through. And every year we'll hear about older and older sites or more sites of that age.
And eventually this will have to be accepted, just like eventually it was accepted that the Earth revolved around the sun.
Or continental drift, or that glaciers actually covered most of the world.
Exactly.
The northern hemisphere.
Exactly.
It took Agassiz and his group a long time
to
get people to believe in glaciers.
Well, we want to thank you, sir, for coming on The Right Perspective and helping us celebrate World Salutrian Day and our world.
Well, I'm glad to know about you. Celebrate it with you.
And we invite you, and next year at our Salutrian Day Parade, we hope to have you as Grand Marshal of the Salutrian Day Parade. Your work is...
I love it.
Thank you, sir, and your work has been invaluable to us, and thank you very much for coming on The Right Perspective. Remember, worldwide Salutrian pride. Thank you.
All right. Good night, sir.
Good night. Yes, that was our guest, Dr. Dennis Stanford, explaining why we are Salutrians, why we believe in Salutrians, and what is Salutria. Our elders have taught us, the voices of our ancestors speak to us again.